The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, Space Show listeners, and welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you all for joining us. Let me run through the announcements and on to our program. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Please be patient. Let the phone ring, and we'll answer it as soon as possible and bring you up on air as soon as possible. And then also remember, you can email us with your comments or questions. It's best to keep them somewhat short. Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then do also remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission to download the programs and share them. Remember, a 90-minute program is about 40 megabytes. And please don't do anything commercial, no edits with the programs, no private YouTube channels. Please don't do written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And then also remember, we're podcasting, and we do always appreciate and thank Andrew over at gigadial.net. They are our podcasting client. You can find the RSS URL on our website and our newsletters if you'd like to subscribe to our podcast. We're heard in iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and a host of other places. If you do have podcasting questions or issues, shoot me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our website is thespaceshow.com, so usually Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening, our fully detailed website newsletter is refreshed and uploaded to our website. It has all of the details of the upcoming week's program, full guest bios, and it is also the only place where you can see the coming events schedule for what's on tap for the Space Show over the next several weeks. Then if we have to change our schedule or make some announcements, this is where you'll find it first. So I strongly suggest you check the website newsletter from time to time to stay current on what's happening with our program. You can subscribe to the very short email announcement newsletter. It goes out electronically early Monday morning, California time. And it's just one or two lines about the week's programming. Very short. Doesn't clutter up your inbox, and I just need your email address to add you to that list, or you can use the pop-up window on our website. A note which I sometimes forget to tell everybody is if you want off of the list, your best bet is to ask me to take you off, because if you unsubscribe through constant contact, I can't add you back if you change your mind. That's one of their rules. So if you want off for any reason, just send me a note and ask me to remove your name, and I will be glad to do that for you. And then if you ever do want back on, it's not a problem. You'll see a Space Show store up at the top of our website. It says Space Show Gear. Please do check it out. Everything we're doing is archived, and all of these programs are still on our website going back to 2001. We're approaching 2,000 programs. You can listen right off of our site or easily download them. There's a guest search tool. You'll see it near the social media buttons. So you can check that out by doing global searches and come up with your favorite space term, like microgravity, for example, or your favorite guest. And then you'll get all of the dates that that person or that topic was mentioned or discussed. And then you can go back to our website and pull those up by date, which is the way our Space Show archives work. You'll see the store, as I said, up there, but probably the most important button is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit, 501c3, with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We exist as a result of your contributions, and we're most appreciative of your support. Remember, if you are paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a deduction, excuse me. And if you pay California taxes, the same thing, as we're a California public benefit corporation. If you have any questions about any of this, do let me know. Finally, remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They do promote cooperative solutions for space security and expansion, by the way. For more information, visit their website. It is www.sw.found.org. And if you have any questions about that, let me know. And also, please remember that Secure World is the sponsor of our webinar series. We have two more planned for this year. They're already listed on the website newsletter coming attractions section. So I'm happy to bring back to our show today one of our favorite guests and authors, Dr. Eric Seedhouse. And today we're talking to Eric about his new book, Ocean Outpost, The Future of Humans Living Underwater, which is published by Springer Praxis. The Amazon information will be in the archives when I publish them later today or very early tomorrow morning. And as you know, on the Space Show, we do quite a few programs during the year about the ocean environment, and we're very interested in that. And there are some similarities and parallels to going into space. So today is one of those programs. His book is excellent. Dr. Seedhouse is an aerospace scientist. He wanted to be an astronaut with the Canadian Space Agency. He was selected as one of the final 30. He is a space consultant and author, a guru, I guess, with human fitness and physical exercise and physical everything that you can imagine. He also is with Astronauts for Hire and very active in the tourism and astronaut development and just people like you and me going up into space. He's over in Canada. And he is with us again today, and will be with us again in a couple of weeks about his book, Astronauts for Hire. Dr. Seedhouse, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Excellent, David. How are you?
Easier to go underwater than to go into space, isn't it?
It depends on what you actually, maybe a little bit easier, but just as dangerous, because depending on how deep you go in the ocean, there are still a lot of things that can happen that can be bad, just like when you're in space. A lot of things that can happen that can be bad for you up there, and it's really just a function of the technology and the degree to which you're pushing the limits. And some of that's alluded to in the book, especially with respect to saturation diving and also breath hold diving or free diving.
So tell us about your book. What is the future for humans living underwater?
Well, hopefully is to establish a permanent underwater presence, and that's something that's never been done. In fact, there are very, very few people who have the aquanaut label. To be an aquanaut, you have to spend 24 hours continuously underwater, and there aren't many people who have done that just because there aren't many underwater habitats. There's one that NASA uses called Aquarius, which it uses to train its astronauts, and those astronauts go down there for 10 to 14 days just to simulate space missions. Then there's the Jules Verne Underwater Lodge, which is a tourism underwater habitat where you can spend $400 or $500 and sleep overnight. But apart from those, there are very, very few underwater habitats where you can actually stay underwater for any length of time. If you do want to spend any time underwater, then you have to become a saturation diver and actually work in the North Sea or work in the Gulf of Mexico or off the California coast. And that is a pretty dangerous proposition.
Is it economics that keeps us from establishing some kind of a long-term, I'm going to use the word residency, but that's probably not the right word to use, but underwater living? I know the oil field, you know, deep divers stay down there for certain terms or tours of duty, right? And then they have to come back up. I don't know how many days they stay down there on their own, but why has it been so challenging and elusive to actually have an an underwater settlement?
Well, partly it's the money and trying to attract potential investors. So, I mean, there are companies out there trying to build underwater habitats. For example, Dennis Chamberlain, he's trying to build an undersea colony. He's trying to establish a permanent undersea colony off the Florida coast. It's going to be called Challenger Station, and that's going to be the first step in building an even larger colony, which is going to be called Atlantica. So he's making progress, but as with everything, it's money, and he's having a difficult time attracting investors. And then there are other places in the world, such as the Poseidon and Hydropolis complexes, which are being developed by Dubai and the Dubai Development and Investment Authority. And so what they're trying to do is trying to get financial backing to build an underwater habitat there, where the suites will go for around $5,000 a night. And then there's another place in Fiji where they're trying to build an undersea habitat, and that's being built by U.S. submarines, or it was. I think that may have stopped by now. But one of the problems is the technology, just trying to get a comfortable habitat at a reasonable depth. And the other is funding. It's just a very, very tight funding environment.
Is there any return to do this commercially? Is there a profit to be made by having an underwater settlement?
Well, that's what these companies think. I mean, Bruce Jones, he's the president of U.S. Submarines. I mean, what they do, the way they get their money is by building custom tourist submarines. So for these rich people have their yachts. What they will do is they want to have a submarine. They'll go to Bruce Jones. He'll build them a tourist submarine, and they'll put the submarine on the back of the yacht. And when they want to go underwater, they'll go touring in the submarines. So there's obviously a market for tourist submarines. And so companies like U.S. Submarines obviously think there's a market for underwater habitats. And so what they're trying to do is get investors to invest in building these structures. So the structure that U.S. Submarines is building is the Poseidon Undersea Resort. Now, that's the one that's being built off Fiji. And then Hydropolis, that's the one that's being built by Dubai Development and Investment Authority. And that's, I think the final cost is going to be around $490 to $500 million. So, I mean, that's the sort of money that we're looking at to build a decent-sized underwater habitat, about $500 million.
So we've heard that some people believe that they can do a humans to Mars mission for that price.
Yes, SpaceX, they think they can do that. And actually, that's the book I'm writing right now, The History of SpaceX. So just written that chapter on their Mars ambitions. If you use a Falcon Super Heavy and add a red dragon on top, then there's your $500 million Mars mission, supposedly.
Interesting. So take us through your book. Where do you start? Where do you leave us? What's in between? Okay.
Yeah. So I start with very, very basic. There's no equipment. With no limits free diving. So free diving is breath hold diving. And that's been around for centuries. So basically what it is you take a big, big breath to the surface, and then you dive down as deep as you can. And in the purest form, there's no equipment except for fins. In the no-limit form, that's something you may have seen in The Big Blue, a famous film by Luc Besson. That's where you go down on the sled, then you have a bottle or cylinder of compressed air attached to your back, and that's what you release to get back up to the surface. And these guys go down to, I think the world record right now is 214 meters, so 700 feet, so below the cruising depth of nuclear submarines. That's where I start, is no limits free diving, just to get people to understand the incredible physiology that's involved in free diving. And then we move on to a little bit deeper. We go to technical diving. That's open scuba. The world record for that is around 313 meters, so just about 1,000 feet. And then we move on to saturation diving, which is even deeper. So in the North Sea right now, we have about half a dozen saturation divers working at around 500 meters. So that's around 1,600, 1,700 feet. And after that, we move on to systems that allow you to go even deeper, which are the atmospheric diving systems, such as the Nuke suit and the ADS suit, which is what the U.S. Navy used, the ADS 2000. Those can go down to about 1,000 meters. And then if you want to go deeper than that, we go into the next chapter, which is submersible and underwater flight. So we actually have some pretty nifty submersibles which are being built now, which James Cameron used earlier this year to get down to the deepest part of the ocean. That's being these are manufactured by Graham Hawke. And these are submersibles that fly underwater. They're very, very maneuverable. They're very, very fast. And they represent the next generation of submersibles. After that, we go into future resorts and habitats, which we just discussed. And then we look at how aquanauts, so for those people who decide to go and live underwater, then what will be the selection criteria? And we'll talk about the similar criteria to selecting astronauts, the crew selection, what are the social skills required, what are the personal medical requirements, what are the crew compatibility traits. And then the final section, we move on to ocean exploitation, because this is really what will drive ocean exploration. This is obviously, tourism is one reason to go down there, but if there are minerals and mineral deposits down there, then that's obviously a good reason to go down there. And there are various companies now exploring the possibility of doing just that. So I explain how we're going to do that. And then finally, we sort of look into the future, and we look at some revolutionary undersea medicine. We're looking at liquid breathing. So for those of you who saw The Abyss, what happened there was exactly what may happen in a few years. We may actually be able to breathe liquid, thanks to researchers that are doing research into fluorocarbons. And then also artificial gills. So this is the next step from liquid breathing, being being able to utilize the oxygen directly from the seawater. And then looking even further over the horizon, we're looking at bioengineering and the possibility of retrofitting the human body with some means of actually utilizing oxygen directly from the seawater, or installing what's called a vasculoid. So this is a nanotechnological device that will actually help the person utilize or better utilize the oxygen available in the ocean. That's pretty much the arc of the book.
How are we, and do you get into this, how are we using space, underwater, to help us with space? So, for example, you know, with the Mars Society, they're always talking about their sites in Utah and up on the Arctic Circle as good study points for, you know, going to Mars and that type of thing. Is the underwater environment being used in a similar way?
Yes, so NASA use an underwater facility called Aquarius, and that's just off the coast of Florida. And what they do every year, they have a mission called the NEMO mission, and they have astronauts there. There's always one as a commander, just like a regular space mission, and then there's the other astronauts are doing the research and science, and they spend between 10 days and 14 days at a depth of around 60 feet in Aquarius doing various scientific studies and basically replicating a space mission. So it's a great analog for being on the International Space Station, because they have link with ground control, Houston, and they're stuck there for the duration. They can't go up. It's a saturation facility. So when they actually finally do leave, they have to undergo a decompression schedule. So it's not like they can go straight up to the surface if they want to break. They're stuck there for the duration. And so that obviously has various psychological tests and various physiological ramifications, similar to what you'd experience in space. So underwater, or being underwater, is a very good analog for that, whether it's in a habitat such as Aquarius, or whether it's just scuba diving. One of the first things that you do when you become an astronaut, certainly with NASA, if you haven't got your scuba qualification, is to get your scuba qualification, because being underwater is a good analog for weightlessness. You're also dependent on life support equipment, which is your diving rig, just like if you're doing a spacewalk, to be dependent on your equipment to do your spacewalk. And again, the knowledge that if something goes wrong, you either have to troubleshoot it or something bad will go wrong. So there is that fear aspect as well, which can be replicated with a high fidelity in the underwater environment. So it is a very valuable environment for space training.
You have an email question, which is the first one of the day. Scott is in Boulder, Colorado, and he says, Eric, you mentioned the divers in the North Sea down to around 1,600, maybe a little bit deeper in footage. How long do they stay down there, and is that akin to an underwater settlement? I'm sure they must have features there, food, entertainment, all sorts of things that would be part of a settlement, minus, I guess, the family support. Can you tell us how long they stay there at a time and what their life support habitats or features are like?
Yeah, so they go down in the saturation complex. They go down for about 14 days, usually 14 days off, 14 days on, 14 days off, or 28 days off, on, 28 days off. And when they're down there, depending on how deep they are, but if they're down at 1,600, 1,700 feet, then they're breathing something called hydrox, which is hydrogen and oxygen, or hydraliox, which is a combination of hydrogen, helium, and oxygen. So it's a very, very advanced mix. So they're breathing this because they're so deep. It's at 51 atmospheres. It's like breathing soup. Very, very, very thick because it's, you're at such great pressure. The life support system, you have, obviously, when you're out there in the water, you're attached to an umbilical. That umbilical has your communication umbilical and your hot water umbilical, because in your diving suit, you have... You have hot water being pumped through filaments in the diving suit to keep you warm, because it's obviously very, very cold down there. It's only about 2 degrees Celsius. When you go back into the saturation complex, it's a very, very primitive area to work in and live in. It's usually very, very cramped, obviously, because space is at a premium, just like it is in space. And that's where you live. You you go out and work for maybe 8 hours a day, then you do your food, deal with the food and rest and sleep and prepare for the next day. That's what you do. That's what you, how you live. And then at the end of the 14 days, that saturation complex is brought up to the surface. It's mated to a decompression chamber that is on the surface. And then the divers who've just come up go into the decompression chamber, decompress, and the next divers go down in the saturation complex. To decompress from 500 meters may take as long as 20 to 30 days. That's how long it takes to decompress from there.
So the 20 to 30 days to decompress from two weeks at 1,600 feet?
That's right, because your tissues are saturated at such a depth, they have to use a decompression table to bring it back very, very slowly.
Yeah.
And that could take up to 20 days.
And so you're in this self-contained chamber. So actually you're spending anywhere from... maybe 4 to 8 weeks in the thing once you go down to when you can walk out and be back on ground.
That's right. Like, if saturation divers would probably make pretty good astronauts, because they're workers, and when they go out of the saturation complex, it's very much like doing an EVA, very much like doing a spacewalk. You're just like astronauts, you're attached to an umbilical. Just like astronauts, you're in a very, very hostile environment. If something goes wrong, then things are going to go bad very quickly. And like I said, there are a lot of analogies between saturation divers and astronauts in that situation.
Pretty incredible that they would do that. Now, since I've been inside Space Shuttle Endeavour, I can absolutely say that these are really cramped quarters. If anybody thinks you got a lot of room inside there with a full crew, you're delusional, because if you're claustrophobic, you're not going to handle it very well. So I would assume we're talking similar kind of cubic footage as a capsule or as a space shuttle, right?
Yeah, it's probably more cramped.
More cramped.
Yeah, and it's more miserable, because it's going to be cold, and you're forced to look at the same faces every day, and it's hard work being a saturation diver out there doing non-destructive testing. You're hauling oxyacetylene welding gear with you at 500 meters depth. It's very, very hard work, physical labor. I know spacewalking is as well, but you're out there getting cold and doing that every single day. It's not like in a spacewalk where you get a couple of days off maybe before the next spacewalk as a saturation diver. You're doing that every single day for the 14 days that you're down there.
Do they have movies and entertainment, or is this really Spartan?
Oh, no, it is Spartan, but they do have movies, and they have regular food. But the taste, once you're down there, because you're breathing this exotic gas mixture, the ability to taste food is degraded. So eating food wasn't a particularly pleasurable experience down there.
So there are some similarities here with the space environment in a way. And so I asked you before the show, the medical problems, like, you know, in space you have the microgravity issues with radiation and bone loss and muscle loss. What do the saturation divers have to endure physically in terms of what's happening to them and their bones and their muscles?
Well, they get something called bone necrosis, just like career astronauts do after a while. But it's the deeper you go, the more advanced that's going to be. So commercial divers who dive on a regular basis at deep depth, they have x-rays every 3 to 4 months to monitor the rate of bone necrosis in their joints. So they have joint x-rays. And the reason for that is because when you go very, very deep, the body's saturated, so it's at maybe 30 or 40 or 50 atmospheres pressure inside the body, and that occludes small blood vessels in the body which need to take nutrients to the bone. And if those are occluded, then the nutrients can't get to the bone, and the bone gradually dies. And so that's one of the biggest occupational hazards for a commercial diver. Other occupational hazards, if a decompression seal fails, then obviously that's a bad day. If any of the life support systems fail, again, there's nobody who can help you. There's nobody who can come from the surface down to your saturation complex and help you. Just like if something goes wrong on a space station, it'd probably take them a while to mount a rescue mission. It's not easy to get to if something goes wrong. So, like I said, there's a lot of analogies there with being in space.
John in San Diego sends in an email, and he says, David, what are the qualifications that one would have to have if they wanted to have a personal submersible, aside from the fact that obviously they would need to afford it and probably be trained on how to use it? What should they physically, mentally, and academically know what to do in order to be safe with a personal submersible?
Size wallet. These submersibles, like Deep Flight 2, Deep Flight 1, they cost about $500,000 to $2 million. In terms of the training, you can go and do pilot training at the, it's called Sub-Aviator Systems, and that's down in California, I think. That's Graham Hawkes' company. And basically, it's 3 days. It's the first day is basic flight skills. For that, you pay $3,500. You get pre-flight instruction on the safety systems, then you get flight control instruction with an instructor, and you do one or two dives. That's about an hour, 2 hours per dive. The next day, that's when you do the co-pilot flight control course. That costs about $6,000. You are trained to use the communication system. You're trained to use the life support system, the emergency equipment, the basic and advanced underwater flight maneuvers, and then you conduct 3 to 4 dives with a total dive time of around 3 to 5 hours. On the third day, that's when you do your advanced flight competency course. That's another $8,000. So in total, if you're adding this up, it's going to cost you about $25,000 to do the course. So on the third day, you're doing the operation of the communication as a standalone. So you just have an instructor supervising or looking on. You have your instructor on life support and emergency equipment. You perform more dives with extended dive times, and you have to demonstrate your flight skills to the instructor. Then you start conducting specialized missions. So if you want to do a wreck inspection, for example, you'll do a wreck inspection mission. And then finally, you'll do your pilot in command flight under the guidance of an instructor. And you'll do 5 or more 6 dives for a total dive time of around 5 or 6 hours. And that's it. But that's the 3 days of training that you need to do to become a pilot of a tourist submarine. So it's going to cost you about $25,000.
If you were submarine trained in the U.S. or some other Navy, would that count for all of this, or would this still be something you'd want to do?
I don't know if there's a waiver. I'm pretty sure there is. If you're trained by the U.S. Navy or a military Navy, I think that probably counts for a lot.
So are you licensed? Do you need a license to work a submersible?
I think you do, yes, for these tourist submersibles. I think you have to have a pilot's wings. So you get wings. It's just like getting your pilot's license. As a submariner, you get your wings at the underwater flight school. So you actually fly these submarines. This new generation of submarines are so maneuverable that you actually fly them.
So Cameron did stuff like this to go down in that thing?
Yeah, so he used the Deep Flight 2, which was the envelope pushing submarine that went down to, I think it was 11,000 meters, so 36,000 feet. And so he actually had one specifically made for him, but it was based on the Deep Flight 2, which was the original one that was being built for Steve Fossett. So Deep Flight 2, the follow-on from Deep Flight 2 was a Challenger. The Challenger was custom built for Steve Fossett, who was going to do the dive that James Cameron did, but Steve Fossett died in the plane accident.
In the plane crash, yeah.
That's right, and the ownership of the vehicle went to Fossett's wife. And so James Cameron didn't have a vehicle to buy, so he had to go to Hawks, and Hawks built a similar vehicle to the Challenger, and that's what the one that James Cameron used to go down to the Mariana Trench in, I think it was March.
And there's no escape if you're down deep from these things, correct? You don't have an escape pod, do you?
I don't think that's the one that James Cameron used. No, I don't think there was anything like that. No, it was a pretty, it was a bold dive. I mean, the last time they did that was in 1960. So it was 52 years since they'd been down to the deepest part of the ocean.
So, Eric, we know you want to go into space, and we've talked about that on previous space show programs. Do you also want to do one of these deep ocean dives? And if you were to tell us which you prefer doing more, are they equal? Do you prefer space over the oceans? How do you see the two for you yourself?
No, space wins hands down every time.
So space is, no matter what, is top dog for you?
Absolutely, yeah, no question. There's no competition.
So, for people who are interested in the oceans and reading, and you kind of start out with the basics here, especially with scuba diving. So starting off with understanding sport diving, I know when I took my diving credentials with NAWI, which I don't even know if that organization exists anymore. I'm going way, way back in time to the late 60s. You know, we got a lot of information on basic oceanography. And the more I dove around with seasoned divers to get more and more experience, the more I learned about oceanography and some of the issues that you're talking about and that are in your book. Is that still the same today? If someone went to your local dive shop down the street, I don't know what their certification might be, but let's assume they get certified. Are they learning enough about basic oceanography and some of the physics and the pressure issues so that they understand that at least the basics of this environment?
Yeah, they get the basics. The leading certification organization in the world is PADI, which is a professional association of diving instructors, and they certify about 75% of all the world's divers. And so what they try and do, it's a business. So like any business, they want to try and pump through as many people as quickly as possible. And so you get taught what you need to know, but not much more than that. So you get taught what you need to be a safe diver. That's the open water scuba course. If you want to go beyond that, then there's technical diving, or you can be a dive master, an assistant instructor, or an instructor. And that's when you obviously learn more. But at the very basic level, it's just really just an introduction to oceanography, it's an introduction to physiology, and an introduction to the skills that you need to keep yourself alive on a regular dive. But beyond that, then there's technical diving, and that's probably where you get a bigger insight into the technical side of things, the equipment, and oceanography itself.
Okay, so someone now wants to ride on a suborbital ship. Let's say they actually do start their commercial operations next year on Virgin or X-Corps or maybe another vehicle. Is being a certified scuba diver, I know it's not a required prerequisite, but would you say having this underwater experience and quite a few dives under your belt, at least to 30, 35 feet, which is one atmosphere, is that a prerequisite in your mind?
It is. I mean, I'm the training director for Astronauts for Hire, and so myself and the training committee, the Astronauts for Hire training committee, we have decided on what the requirements and qualifications are to be a suborbital astronaut. For our organization, one of the requirements is a NAWI or PADI equivalent for open water diver. So you have to have scuba experience to become a certified suborbital astronaut for our organization. There's a few reasons for that. First is the analog, the weightlessness. It helps you understand what it feels like to be weightless, although you can do that on parabolic flight, which is also a requirement, but it costs $5,000, which is pretty expensive. It's a lot cheaper just to get your scuba license.
Trust me, given all my diving, it's a lot more fun to go underwater, especially in some of the ocean-rich environments with a lot of life in them. It's just an amazing world.
Yeah, and there's that as well. And then the second thing is the fear factor. Okay, it's not super dangerous being going on a dive, but there is that knowledge that you are dependent on your life support system, and that's the same sort of environment that you're going to face when you're on a suborbital flight. You will be dependent on life support systems or a life support system functioning well, and that's again another analogy you have with scuba diving. So for our organization, we recommend, well, it's not recommended, it's a requirement that you have scuba experience. The better, the more, the better.
So this is just a question on my own. I mean, we were taught when I did my NAWI training that we were dependent and never to dive without a buddy. So that was our primary, you know, safety crutch. So is that still the way getting certified is taught today, or do they look more to your hardware and to your life support systems than your buddy, or do they even encourage you to always dive with a buddy?
It's always a buddy system. I mean, there was talk of one of the organizations putting out a solo diving qualification, which you can do once you're qualified. But really the only people who do solo diving nowadays are technical divers. People like Mark Elliott, who has a world record now for the deepest dive on technical scuba gear. They're really the only people. And even then, there's very few technical divers who will dive alone. Because it's just too dangerous.
What is actually meant by a technical diver?
Technical diving is usually diving below the depth recommended by the international training agencies. So, for example, if you're a paddy diver, and the recommended maximum depth is 40 meters, so about 130 feet. Technical diving, because you're using advanced or exotic gas mixtures such as nitrox and hydrox and hydraliox and heliox and all these other oxes, means you can dive deeper for longer. But with that increased depth comes increased risk, which is why when you see technical divers, they have two or three of everything. They have a huge amount of redundancy built into their systems. They have three regulators, two or three masks. They have backup cylinders and backup cylinders to backup cylinders in case those fail. They have all sorts of equipment to try and keep them alive in case something fails. But these systems will allow them to go to very, very much, much deeper depths than recreational scuba. So, for example, a standard technical dive may go down to 80 or 90 or 100 meters, whereas, as I said before, the recommended depth or maximum depth with a regular certifying agency is 40 meters. And then some of the really envelope-pushing technical divers, they'll go down to 200 or 250 or even deeper. So for example, Mark Elliott, he's the guy who holds the world record on open water scuba. A couple of years ago, he dove down to 313 meters on open water scuba.
That's 1,000 feet, Eric.
That's 1,000 feet using technical diving equipment.
Okay, well, when I was young and foolish and went on a trip with a guy who is no longer alive now, Ken Siebold, out of Corona del Mar, a very unfortunate traffic accident decades ago. We did bounce dives on the barrier reef in Fiji for black coral to around 250 and 300 feet. So
On air,
yeah. So, you know, we had, it took a lot of planning, and, you know, we had zero bottom time. And we were strapped to a line, and we had divers stationed at certain intervals on the line while the fools went down. We came up, and we had extra tanks hanging on the line for decompression with Navy tables. And it was a lot of fun, but, you know, again, I'm 20 years old, or 21 years old. Ken was killed in a tragic car accident with his family taking bold chances on the road like we did on the water. So what can I say? You know, youth has its folly, Eric. But good memories come with it when everything works right. I don't encourage it, but looking back on it, I laugh at how foolish and stupid we were in doing things, but sometimes good memory. Do you think that that space is, I mean, we're not very well developed in dealing with how to live underwater and how to maximize the human potential for the oceans, either commercially or in any way whatsoever. And we're also trying to do all of this in space, too. Do you see space being developed and settled before we're able to figure out how to do this right here on Earth in the oceans? Or do you think that we will finally get it together and the people working really hard to do this in the oceans will somehow come through ahead of when we're able to do this, say, on Mars or even on the Moon?
No, I think space will be commercialized first just because of the money. You look at the budget of the NOAA, the National Oceanographic Administration, and NASA. Last year, I think, or no, 2 years ago, the NOAA budget was around $38 million. And you look at NASA, I guess about $15, $16, $17 billion. It's just the money. It's just the sheer money. So space will be commercialized first, I'm sure. There's a lot of work going towards commercializing the ocean. What I mean by commercializing the ocean, we're talking about things like bioprospecting. We're looking for things that can be mined underwater, and also deep ocean exploration, looking at novel biology of various organisms that can be used in the medical trade. A lot of the anti-cancer drugs that are being used now, a lot of those have their origins in ocean plants and ocean biology. As well as bioprospecting, then you have the mining companies who are looking to mine various parts of the ocean for various. What they're mining now, but, well, obviously oil is one thing. Then you have the minerals, and then the other one is renewable energy sources. So we're looking at geothermal energy, and a couple of those companies, such as Neptune and Technip, they're two European companies. They're doing work in the Gulf of California, Gulf of Mexico, and a few other places to try and extract some of these minerals, and also to extract some of these geothermal energy sources. But even with all those opportunities to mine the ocean, it's just not going to take off on the same level as space, I don't think.
One more question, and we'll take our break because we're halfway through the program. And again, listeners, we do prefer phone calls, and it is 1-866-687-7223. Andy is in Tucson, and he says there's lots of talk among space policy people that they want to avoid for space the mistakes that have been made for the oceans with the Law of the Sea Treaty. Do you see anything in the Law of the Sea Treaty that truly does inhibit commercial development or settlement development in the oceans that needs to be avoided for space?
I think they probably have tighter regulations for the ocean than they do for space. The various treaties that companies have to abide by when they're mining and when they're prospecting. So, for example, we have the Antarctic Treaty that covers the exploitation of oil. We also have the Madrid Protocol, which is also known as the Protocol on Environmental Protection to the Antarctic Treaty. That covers moratoriums on mining and drilling for 50 years in that area. And then for other areas, you also have various treaties that have to be abided by when you're actually embarking on any exploration or exploitation activities, especially in some of the deep waters off the Atlantic coast and also in the North Sea. So there are regulations there in some areas. That's not to say all areas. So I think it's less regulated in the South Pacific and the South Atlantic than it is in the North Pacific and the North Sea. So there are treaties and regulations in place there, whereas space, we have the Outer Space Treaty, which was, I think we developed that in the 1960s. We have 12 countries signed up for that. But it does, there are various get-out clauses, various ways you can step around some of those rules and regulations in the space treaty.
Andy, I think the Law of the Sea Treaty, and maybe a knowledgeable lawyer or somebody will call in, and if I'm wrong, they can spank my hands and correct us. But it calls for benefit sharing of anything and everything that's done in the ocean and resource development, if you're mining or something like that. And that has been a big resistance point in commercializing space. So I think that that's a major obstacle that does hinder ocean development to some degree, and the space people don't want to go down that road at all. I don't know. Do you have any comments on benefit sharing?
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with that area, so I only really mentioned the regulations briefly in the book. I didn't really go into that very much. Really, what I really talk about is the exploitation and the exploration aspects. So the legal aspects really are something I sidestep in the book. So I really can't comment on that one.
How do you define, I mean, I know it's in the book in Chapter 6, but for people who haven't yet read your book, an ocean outpost as compared to a habitat or something else? What are you talking about, a military outpost? What are you talking about with ocean outpost? And then we'll go to our break.
Yeah, we're talking about somewhere where somebody can establish a permanent presence underwater. That's an outpost. So a resort or an underwater habitat, for example. So, for example, the Jules Undersea Lodge where you can stay overnight, that's a habitat. That is not designed for permanent presence, so it is not an outpost. When we talk about outposts, we're talking about permanent presence underwater. When we're talking about habitats, we're talking about a temporary presence underwater, 24 hours, 2 days, a week. That's the distinction between outposts and habitats.
You know, they say that every time they do surveys or ask people, that there's no shortage of people that would do a one-way Mars trip if that were possible to do. Are there similar large groups of people that would live in a permanent underwater outpost?
Well, I think Dennis Chamberlain has a few recruits that he has in mind for that. I think that's, I mean, their first outpost mission, I think, is going to be 90 days, or maybe it's 45 days, with the second mission being 90 days. But that's what they're looking to do. They're looking to establish a permanent presence underwater. I'm pretty sure it's not going to be one way, because I don't think the technology is there yet, but I seem to remember reading his book, and I think that was the distant goal, was to actually have people who actually adapted, who are actually born underwater, who actually live underwater, and actually stay underwater. I think that was one of the goals.
Listeners, we're going to take our break, and we'll be back in 3 minutes with Eric Seedhouse. So we're talking about his book, which is Springer Praxis, Ocean Outpost, The Future of Humans Living Underwater. And one of the great assets of this book is not only does he have diagrams and pictures of the technology that is actually available today to do things underwater and to go underwater, but he goes into the technical sides of all of this. And you don't usually find this in underwater, you know, kind of settlement books. They're more philosophical. And sometimes more, I don't know how you would say it, idealistic or rah-rah-rah, sis-kum-bah kind of thing. But Eric has the hard facts here and lots of technical diagrams and hardware diagrams, and you can see what this stuff is and what it's involved in. And I've seen a lot of books supporting or doing more and more things with the ocean, and I think Eric's book stands alone. So, again, we'll continue talking about Ocean Outpost, The Future of Humans Living Underwater, published by Springer Praxis. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is the second part of our Sunday program today with Dr. Eric Seethaus. We're discussing his book, Ocean Outpost, The Future of Humans Living Underwater. Our phone number, again, for those of you who would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. Eric, what is biochemical decompression? So this was new to me when I was reading your book.
Yeah, so back in the 90s, Susan Cahar, a researcher who works for the U.S. Navy, she was tasked to find a way of decompressing Navy divers quicker and without the problems of lengthy decompressions, because the deeper you go, the longer you have to decompress to the surface. And obviously, time means money. So if you can find a way of decompressing divers quicker, then obviously you save money, and it's obviously safer for the divers. So what she did, she went to work on some nitrogen-metabolizing bacteria. So there are some bacteria out there called Methanobrevibacterium smithii, and this particular bacteria metabolizes nitrogen. So what she did, she injected these bacteria into pigs. She decompressed them to several hundred meters, and then because the bacteria metabolized the nitrogen, sorry, hydrogen in this case, the decompression times were halved. And so this is all published in 98 and 99 in various journals. And then for some reason, that funding was stopped. So we never got the human trials, but the science is sound. So if you can introduce nitrogen or hydrogen metabolizing bacteria into the body during a deep dive, then you should be able to reduce the decompression time. So that's biochemical decompression.
So they did this with pigs, but didn't get to take it further into human trials, right?
Yeah, I met Susan Cahar at a conference in 2000, and I asked her about this, and she was given no reason for why the funding was cut. But all the trials were successful. It's been published. There's three or four articles about the research that she did, and it was pioneering research. No such research has been done since on biochemical decompression. And it's sound science.
Seems to me that would be a high priority and wouldn't require an enormous amount of funding.
Nope. That's why I'm surprised nobody else has picked up where she left off.
Are there other innovative ways of mitigating the need for lengthy decompression times?
Yeah, you can breathe liquid. So, for example, back in 1989, if you remember the film The Abyss,
uh-huh.
And Ed Harris breathes liquid. So when James Cameron, because we all know James Cameron is a big diving fanatic, he got the father of liquid breathing to come on the set of The Abyss to make sure that everything he did was technically accurate. And the father of liquid breathing is a guy called Johannes Kilstra. He passed away a couple of years ago. But he was doing this research way back in the 60s. He was doing research on dogs. And he even did a human trial where he filled one lung with liquid. Back in those days, there was a problem because the liquid aggravated the lining of the lung, and so it was very painful for the human subject. But now what we have is something called perfluorocarbon liquids, PFCs, and these are used with infants that have acute respiratory distress syndrome. So for those infants who have undeveloped lungs, or which means their lungs can't carry as much, or can't utilize oxygen from the air as well, then what they do, they introduce these PFCs into the baby's lungs, and so these babies are liquid breathing. And now what some diving researchers thought of doing is making this technology available to divers. So one of the big problems was being able to extract the carbon dioxide from the circuit, because obviously just like a regular air diving circuit, you have to have fluid going through a circuit so you can actually get the oxygen from the fluid, but you also have to get rid of your carbon dioxide. So basically it wasn't a biological or a physiological problem, it was an engineering problem. Last year, I think it was a German scientist, he's patented the equipment to do this. So hopefully in the next year or two, we will actually be able to have a system where we can actually breathe liquid.
Is the liquid, what is the liquid? It's not just water or salt water, it's something different, right?
No, it's a PFC, so perfluorocarbon. It's manufactured by a couple of companies in the world. I think one is Alliant Pharmaceutical in California. And what it is, these PFC liquids have a quarter of the surface tension, or 16 times the oxygen solubility, and 3 times the carbon dioxide solubility of water. So it's fantastic for dissolving carbon dioxide, and it's excellent for carrying oxygen. So these are perfect liquids for diving. In terms of actually breathing it, then it's probably going to be similar to what you saw in the abyss when Ed Harris's lungs were filled up. It'll be pretty distressing to begin with, but once you realize that you can actually breathe the liquid, then like you saw in the abyss, Ed Harris calmed down after a while, and he was able to do what he needed to do.
I guess I'm going to have to rent that film again, because I don't really remember that much about it. But sounds like I should get refreshed on it. Are there any new techniques for decompressing if you end up getting bent or have decompression sickness? Has the technology advanced in treating that so that you don't have to spend so much time in a chamber or something of that nature?
Oh, we still have the dive tables. Another invention on the horizon is artificial gills. So there's a guy in Israel called Alan Bodner. He's actually sold this invention to the Israeli Defense Force. He's actually demonstrated it on Discovery Channel. So he's actually breathed through an artificial gill. So this isn't something that you install on the human body. This is something that you wear externally. And what it does, the water passes through the gill, and it extracts the oxygen from the seawater and passes it through a respirator or a conversion device to your respirator. So you actually breathe oxygen directly from the seawater. And this is a system that Alan Bodner has devised. And it's called Like a Fish. That's his invention. And you can go to Discovery Channel and probably punch it into Google and actually see this working. You can actually see Alan Bodner breathing through an artificial gill system. And it's very, very simple. It works similar to a closed-circuit rebreather, I guess. That would be one way of explaining it. And basically, all it consists of is a small motor, a pump, an air separator, a compressed air tank, and a little centrifuge that has to spin the water to actually get the oxygen out of the liquid.
There's some really exciting cutting-edge things going on in the ocean that we don't hear that much about. This seems to me like this is probably better kept secrets on technology than even things going on in space.
What is it? Because space gets all the attention. I mean, we read about the science and the research and everything else and all the advances that go on the International Space Station, but we don't read so much about what we find and what we discover under the ocean. So people may be surprised to know about all the anti-cancer drugs that are actually discovered underwater that actually have been bioprospected and brought to market. So we have anti-cancer drugs from sponges. These are commercially available. We have anti-tuberculosis agents from sponges, underwater sponges. We have anti-HIV agents called Ascidian. This is from Ascidian, which is a sponge which you find underwater. We have anti-malarial agents that are actually used, that are derived from ocean plants. We have even medical devices. We have coal that is used for bone grafts. We have diagnostics, means of detecting endotoxins. These are found in the horseshoe crab. We have nutritional supplements, microalgae, that are used in polyunsaturated fatty acids, in food additives. These are commercially available. These are all drugs and supplements that have been found underwater that have been brought to market as a result of bioprospecting. So whereas we may read and hear a lot about all the science that's going on in the International Space Station, there's just as much going on underwater.
I got a quick email from Sally, who is in Los Angeles, and she says, can you spell the name of the Israeli person? I can't understand it. Is it Bonder, B-O-N-D-E-R, or is it somebody else?
Alan Bodner, B-O-D-N-E-R.
B-O-D, okay.
Yeah, Alan Bodner.
Okay, I guess she wants to go Google him or something like that. You have a caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, this is Terry in Corpus Christi.
Hi, Terry. Go for it.
Hi. Dr. Seedhouse, it's always good to have you on the show. What is your best guess on how long it's going to be before we could have maybe an outpost large enough on the sea bottom to do maybe minor mining or something like that? 100 years, maybe? That long?
No. In terms of mining, I don't know. If you look at saturation complexes, you could almost call those outposts, but it's not permanent. So they go down for quite a while. So they're down for anything between 14 and 28 days sometimes. If we're looking at the near term in terms of establishing a commercial outpost, then you probably the best bet is probably going to be Dennis Chamberlain and his Atlantica project. So he has a website. I can't remember the website. I think it's just called Atlantica.com, and you can see where they are in terms of building the Challenger station, which is going to be the outpost. And the date keeps on slipping because they don't get the money, but they're still pushing ahead. And I'm hoping by the end of this decade there will be a permanent outpost, and that will probably be as a result of Dennis Chamberlain's work.
An outpost shallow enough to do maybe some minor farming, you know, for a self-sustaining outpost, maybe in the Florida area, is that a possibility, like at 60 feet or something like that?
Yeah, I think the Atlantica project, the Atlantica outpost is going to be a little bit deeper than that. It's going to be off the east coast of Florida. The first mission is going to be a 45-day mission. That's going to be followed by a 90-day mission. And the objective, ultimately, is to make it self-sustaining. So using a lot of the technologies that are used in bioprospecting, they'd use those technologies to make the outpost self-sustaining that way.
Well, that's great. It's great to talk to you again, and I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Hey, Terry, Dennis has been on the show before. Have you heard his program?
Yes.
Yeah, because I was going to point you to it if you had not heard of it. Maybe we should see how he's doing if he wants to come back on the program. It's been a couple of years.
That'd be great.
Okay, thank you very much, Terry,
thanks
for calling in.
Take care. Bye.
So, listeners, the line is available still for you to use, and that is 1-866-687-7223. Eric, is the liquid-breathing artificial gill area, is that the most advanced part of research right now for relating to underwater habitats and underwater settlements? Is that the cutting edge, or are there other areas too that are going on parallel?
Well, the cutting edge of cutting edge, I think, is probably in the area of bioengineering, and we're talking nanotechnology now. So one of the bioengineering concepts is something called a vasculoid. So this is medical nanotechnology. And a vasculoid is basically something that will help divers breathe liquid or use artificial gills to extract oxygen in the same way that Alan Bodner's invention does. But it's a little bit more revolutionary than that. It's developed by two scientists, Robert Freitas and Christopher Phoenix. And basically this vasculoid basically exchanges regular blood with the vasculoid. So this vasculoid comprises of 500 trillion units. That's about as many blood cells as you have in your body. Each of these units replicates the oxygen and nutrient-carrying capabilities of a blood cell, but they're ruggedized, so they're able to tolerate much greater pressure, and they can obviously utilize oxygen with greater efficiency than a regular blood cell. So what would happen if you were to have this basculoid installed, and that's the term that Freitas and Phoenix used to do this, you'd actually exsanguinate the blood, so you'd have all your blood taken out in a special procedure, and then you'd have this basculoid installed in the body, and then this nanotechnological device that you'd be installed with would be able to allow you to not have to decompress. It would allow you to go much, much deeper, and you'd be able to extract oxygen from water much more efficiently. So that's probably the most revolutionary concept out there in terms of applications for diving and for space travel as well.
Listeners, Dr. Seathouse covers this in his book. It's in Chapter 10 called Becoming Home Aquatics, but it goes into the areas that he's been summarizing for us right now. Are we years off from this kind of technology being operational, or is it much closer than that?
Well, the basculoid was, the concept was published in a paper way back in 99, and then since then, you can keep up with the technology on a website. It's called nanomedicine.org or nanomedicine.com, and the science is solid. It's just that we're not there in terms of being able to manufacture this device, because it is a device. It's not something biological or physiological. It's actually a nanotechnological device. It's difficult to say when we'll be able to do this, maybe in 10, 15 years, but right now we're not at that stage.
So we're talking about a hardware device that's needed here.
Yeah, it's a nanobot. It's a nanotechnological device.
So assuming some of this in the ocean world becomes operational, is there any correlation to it for space, or is this really unique to underwater and not to space?
Well, no, if you read the paper on the basculoid, then you can customize it. So you can customize the basculoid for deep sea exploration. You could customize it for astronauts. So, for example, this basculoid, because it's very, very efficient at utilizing oxygen, and withholding oxygen and releasing oxygen to the cells, you could potentially have an astronaut doing an EVA without an EVA suit. Not for very long, maybe 20 to 30 minutes. I think that's the number that they come up with in the paper. But that's where you would customize it for an astronaut, yeah, to allow him to do an EVA or to do an EVA without the suit, utilizing this basculoid.
Pretty amazing. If that gets perfected.
Well, they've been working on it for a long time, so honestly, I'm not sure what the stage they're at right now. But there are people working on this, and have been working on it for over a decade now, and they're still making progress. I can't say when it's going to be operational, or when you'd be able to have this installed in you.
Let me give you the question from the listener by email first. And this is Roger, and Roger says he's in Miami. I guess that's Miami, Florida. He didn't specify. And he says, David frequently has a guest on the show about human factors in space, Dr. Bill Rowe. Dr. Rowe pretty much thinks that the only way humans will ever do long-duration spaceflight or maybe space settlement is through genetic modification. Is there any parallel for genetic modification for being on an ocean settlement?
Well, the bioengineering aspect, which I mentioned already, if you have a one-atmosphere settlement, then there's really no need for bioengineering or genetic modification or genetic engineering, because it's a one-atmosphere settlement. The only reason you'd use genetic engineering or genetic modification would be for maybe saturation divers, just to make their lives easier, to make their lives safer. But for people who are living permanently in a one-atmosphere outpost, there's probably no requirement for that.
Because they still have the 1G of gravity that they're dealing with, correct?
That's right.
A lot of people disagree even with genetic modification for space and think it's really way out there, that there would probably be better mitigating strategies closer in and less costly. Have you ever looked into genetic modification for space travel?
Well, the obvious one would be something to offset bone atrophy, so to make the bone stronger. I think the closest thing to, not necessarily genetic modification, but cloning, I think that's probably a better use of that type of technology. So if you've seen the movie Moon, where they actually have cloned astronauts doing the heavy drudge work, then maybe there's a rationale for that. So why have regular humans do the dirty work when you can have cloning?
You didn't know they were cloned until much further into the movie.
No, but it's a similar technology to genetic engineering. And obviously that brings into question all these ethical issues, whether a clone is a human being and whether it has the same rights. But I think that's one application or one potential application of that sort of technology. In terms of genetic engineering, then you're looking at strengthening bones. So you'd have astronauts have stronger bones to offset the bone atrophy process. That would be one manipulation that you could have. The eyesight problem that they're discovering now, or they're discovering in the last few years, you'd guard against that, by genetic manipulation, so they don't have astronauts losing their sight after 5 or 6 months on the space station. So yeah, you basically customize an astronaut using those manipulations.
You have another email, and this is from Harris in St. Louis, and he says, Dr. Seedhouse, I have all of your books, and I have this one as well. And I notice that there are lots of pictures of various undersea submersibles, pieces of technology. Obviously, there's a lot of companies engaged in trying to develop underwater tools, underwater vehicles, and to commercialize on what the oceans offer us. Can you compare this hardware development effort and all of these different participants to a similar type of hardware development going on in suborbital as well as orbital space, mostly in the United States, but also around the world? Are the two industries somewhat comparable in their character?
Well, first of all, thanks for buying all the books. Appreciate that. And, some of the technologies are similar. So obviously the life support systems that are being developed for these submersibles, the life support systems that are being developed for the habitats, the underwater habitats, and the suborbital vehicles, both have a lot of similarity. In terms of the money being pumped into these, it's night and day. I mean, you look at X-Corp, you look at Virgin Galactic, you look at the budgets of those companies, and then you look at the budget of Graham Hawkes' company. He's the one that builds the Deep Flight 2 and the Challenger underwater submersibles and the other commercial submersibles available, like U.S. submarines. They just don't have the budget. I mean, the development and the R&D budget is very, very low compared to even startups like X-Corp and fully-fledged suborbital companies like Virgin Galactic. So they're fighting an uphill battle. I mean, they're doing fantastic work. They're doing the submarines that Graham Hawkes has developed and flown, absolutely amazing, absolutely incredible vehicles. But he's been at it a long time, and just like pretty much anybody in this industry, he's had to fight very hard to get the investors and the money and the funding to actually develop these vehicles. So they've had a very long lead time just because he hasn't had the money. And there's a parallel there in the space industry. Obviously, it's very difficult to develop these technologies and to get the money and the funding to do the necessary R&D. But there's more of it, and a lot more. So that's where I see the parallel. Some of the technologies obviously being very, very similar, but in terms of the funding and the money available to do the R&D, it's night and day.
So as much as we hear about the struggling new space or space industry, it's still way beyond what goes on in the undersea industry for hardware.
Yeah, I mean, you pick up Popular Science or Popular Mechanics, you pick up Wired Magazine or Scientific American, and you can always find an article about commercial space flight, suborbital flight, X or SpaceX, whatever company, but very rarely do you read about Graham Hawkes or the push to build these groundbreaking, envelope-pushing submersibles. Very, very rarely, even James Cameron's pioneering dive to the Mariana Trench. That wasn't even on the front page of the newspaper. And this was the first time it had been done in 52 years. He was resigned to page 2 or page 3 of a newspaper. You can bet your life when Virgin Galactic goes up next year, hopefully next year, that's going to be on the front page. Underwater exploration doesn't have the pull for the media.
Yeah, I remember when Cameron did it, all my internet news sources, I was getting National Geographic articles about it. And I wasn't getting anything coming in from the regular news sources that I believe in. I mean, I think a couple of days later they started reporting it. But everything coming in initially was off of National Geographic and other, you know, more esoteric science-oriented or adventure type of sites. So you're absolutely right about that, which is unfortunate. But I guess, as they say, it is the way it is, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, that is thing. Is there a comparable with an underwater diving suit and a spacesuit?
Well, again, the systems are similar. So depending on whether you're talking about a saturation suit, which is what the saturation divers use, or whether you're talking about the one atmosphere suit, like the ADS 2000 or the new suit, then life support systems are very much the same. I mean, you obviously have to have carbon dioxide scrubbers. You obviously have to have a means of delivering air to the diver, and you obviously have to make that system rugged and have it so the diver can actually move around in the suit, just like the astronaut can move around in his suit. So the suits out there right now, the ADS 2000, that's the one the U.S. Navy uses. That has, I think, a capability of going down to, I think it's 1,000 feet. And I think it's deeper than that. Maybe it's 600 meters. Yeah, 600 meters is the limit of the ADS 2000. So that's around 2,000 feet. So these systems can go down very deep, and they utilize the same basic life support system technology that the EVA suit has.
So there are some similarities there.
Yeah, they have to have a means of measuring the oxygen percentage. They have to measure the carbon dioxide concentration, the pressure inside the suit, the cabin and the water temperature. Obviously, it's not a big deal with the EVA suit, but they have to have atmospheric monitoring, obviously, within the suit. They have to have displays that monitor feedback about the suit systems, just like the EVA suit has. They have microprocessor and power supply status, troubleshooting aids, just like the EVA suit. They have all these systems are almost identical to what you'd have in an EVA suit.
Excuse me. Sarah is in Long Beach, California. She sent in an email for you, and she says, I'm curious. I do assume you do some public outreach speaking or educational outreach speaking. If you do it both on oceans as well as on space, can you tell a difference in your audience reception, size of audience, and audience interest between the two topics, ocean as compared to space?
I've actually only done a couple on the subject of ocean outpost, this book, and that was for, I remember the company now. It was Procter & Gamble, that's right. Procter & Gamble in New York last year, so they invited me to give a talk about two books, my Ocean Outpost book and one of the space books. So what they wanted to do, they wanted to use aspects of the technology in these books to use in a focus group to simulate ideas about how best to advertise their products. So I spent about 45, 50 minutes talking about both books, the technology in each, and I would say there were probably more questions that was stimulated about the space exploration than the ocean exploration. So, just because people are exposed to it on a more regular basis, so they tend to understand it more, or they feel more comfortable talking about space exploration than they do about ocean exploration, because it's not something that they read about very often.
Did they ever create any ads that you're aware of out of this focus group for either ocean focus or space focus?
No, this is internal to Procter & Gamble.
Interesting that they would even think about that.
It was unusual. At first I thought it was an unusual fit, but then they invited me into the focus group, and I got an understanding of how they use this information. So they get different speakers every year to do exactly what I did, talk about what they do, and then they use the information or the ideas from that talk and try to integrate it into the focus group to help to best advertise their product. So it actually does make sense. Once I was sitting in the focus group, it actually did make sense.
Could you tell if the people had any space cadets in the audience, or were they just like a general population that likes to put Hubble pictures on their desktop or Jacques Cousteau pictures on their desktop or something like that, but not really a space cadet or an ocean cadet?
No, most of them, they just had a general idea of what was going on in terms of ocean exploration, space exploration. There were a couple who knew about the X-Prize, there were a couple who knew about Virgin Galactic, but that was really the extent of how much they knew.
You have a caller. This might be our last call and question of the day, as we're approaching the end of the program. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John, Atlanta.
Hi, John. By the way, are you the John in Atlanta that posted something on what's that thing that where they want to, you know, have the archives on the moon? You know what I'm talking about? Life something. I'm having a senior moment.
I don't think so.
There's a John Hunt who posted a discussion on, I can't believe I can't remember what it is, but I'm really blanking out on this. Anyway, that's not why you called, but...
Was this something that happened recently?
Yeah, I saw it a couple of days ago on one of my, what's the name of the group that wants to, you know, have a safety guard for humanity and store archives and everything on the moon? I can't.
I didn't post that, no.
I can't think of the name of it, but it was John Hunt, and I think it was from Atlanta. So
there's two of us here, huh?
Yes, there must be another one for me there. Anyway, go ahead with Eric, please.
Some of these ideas are really, there's liquid breathing. How does one transition to it and out of it? It seems like that would be a very difficult process once you got into it to get out, or when you're breathing air to get into it.
Well, no human's done that except for one human in the 1960s who had one lung filled with liquid. And he found it very unpleasant because the surfactant is something that lines your lungs, and that was irritated by the liquid going in. But we don't have that problem nowadays with the PFCs. So all we know is how dogs tolerate it, because Johannes Kilstra, who is the father of liquid breathing, he did test it on dogs. And so they put them in these pressure chambers and then filled the pressure chambers up with liquid. And then, obviously, the dogs couldn't give much feedback, but after struggling for a while, they did settle down. And there's video footage of these dogs, one of which was called Snibby, a Mongol dog that was used. And he was the first mammal to survive liquid breathing. So I think he was underwater for 24 minutes. So he was breathing liquid for 24 minutes, and after he was resuscitated, he made a full recovery and went to live up the rest of his days as a mascot on a submarine rescue vessel. So we do know dogs can survive. Obviously, I think it will be very similar to what you see in the Abyss, because Johannes Kilstra was on set as an advisor to James Cameron for that scene. And it'll be pretty uncomfortable to begin with. But once you realize you can actually extract the oxygen from the liquid, then I think you'll settle down.
Okay, well, the dog didn't bite him after it was over with, huh?
Oh, no.
Just kidding.
I wonder if you could do that experiment today, or if that would be considered torture, and you wouldn't get approvals to do an animal experiment like that.
Probably not, no. Not the way with that committee. Not today, no.
So it would be really hard to replicate that today. Interesting.
Unless it was a military budget. I think the military has more flexible ethics committees.
I wouldn't put my dog through that.
Well, I wouldn't put my cat through it either.
There are some people I would put through it.
Yeah.
This gives a new definition to waterboarding, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's why I said it just sounded like something would be rather unpleasant. I'm not saying it's survivable, but another thought on this is it seems like the ocean would be an area. Everybody talks about commercial space and big, this is being a big advantage, but in ocean, I would think that would be the area where commercial would work, because it wouldn't seem to me that the kind of money, there would be access to resources that could be relatively easily obtained once everybody went down there and extracted them. Getting them to the surface at that point, once they're extracted, wouldn't be too hard. And so they would be, they'd be readily available on Earth. That would seem to be a lot more exploitable than, let's say, bringing back minerals from the moon or an asteroid would be.
Quite to a degree, but some of these minerals are very, very deep. So, for example, in the Arctic, some of these minerals are down at depths of 1,000 meters or more, and some of these geothermal energy sources, they're very, very deep as well. And so even with remote submersibles, I mean, some of these geothermal sources or the hydrothermal sources are down at 2,500, 3,000 meters. That's very, very deep. And to try and get a submersible down there and then to actually build a system to actually extract that energy, that's very, very difficult. That's tougher than working in space.
Yeah. That would be difficult, but I mean, but the energies involved, I mean, wouldn't be nearly as extreme as far as transporting things back and forth. It's just a matter of developing, like you say, all the things you've been talking about and getting that going. But the other thing about, the final thing about the idea of like settlements or outposts down there, I think that doesn't that pose another interesting dilemma for us? I mean, how many people would really want to permanently live under the ocean? And it's an interesting question, huh? I mean,
yeah, probably not as many people as would like to live in space permanently, but Dennis Chamberlain, he's got a number of people who've signed up for his expedition. So they've signed up for the 45-day expedition and the 90-day expedition. How many people would actually want to live there permanently? I'm not sure, but there are at least a few. But like I say, not as many as probably would like to live in space.
Yeah. But, all right, well, anyway, a very fascinating discussion. You certainly brought a lot of things to my attention I was not that well aware of. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling in, John. I appreciate it.
Listeners, if you want to call and talk to Eric, you really have to bust your chops to do it quickly. And our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So you're scheduled to return in a couple of weeks about your book, Astronauts for Hire, correct?
Yes, 3 weeks, I think.
21st
of October?
Yeah, near the end of October. And we're looking forward to that. And then you have more books in the works, so you will be returning again. Are you scheduled on any of... Oh, you got another caller. So here, let me take that real quick. Hold on. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug. Go for it.
Yeah, I apologize that maybe somebody earlier had already asked this question, but in terms of sort of recycling life support, of doing so chemically versus biologically, I presume undersea habitats are chemical recycling. Has there been any thought in terms of doing biological?
Yeah, as far as I know. And again, this is a function of how much money is available there to do R&D. There's just not as much to do R&D for underwater technology as there is for space technology. So in terms of a closed environmental life support system or biological life support system, as far as I know, there's nothing in the pipeline for that. The saturation systems, even the latest ones, the latest saturation complexes, still use standard life support system technology.
Would, you know, it seems to me as though in terms of space colonies, you would want to really provide everything from the immediate location. So it doesn't have to be 100% self-sustaining. You could, for example, if you're on the moon, you could go out and keep inputting more ice, for example, to produce water and oxygen, et cetera. But yeah, under the ocean, to me, it's so close to the rest of the world that making ongoing deliveries would be a significant difference of an undersea colony versus a off-Earth colony.
Yeah, I mean, the goal of any life support system is a closed one, so you don't have anything lost to the atmosphere or anything lost outside the system. So you're looking at a closed environmental life support system. Ideally, if you could make that a bioregenerative life support system, then that would probably be the best. I mean, that's pretty much the gold standard in life support systems. But even with all the money thrown at development life support systems in the space arena, we're still not there yet. We still don't have a completely closed environmental life support system.
Either chemically or biologically regenerative?
No, we're still losing oxygen or carbon dioxide, or we're still losing something to the atmosphere, so we still don't have a closed environmental life support system. And the next step from that would be bioregenerative. So first of all, we have to make a closed one. Once we can make a closed one, then we can look at a bioregenerative one, and we're still away from doing that. Once we can do that for space vehicles, then we can look at doing that for underwater habitat.
As a general, bioregenerative is more difficult than chemical?
Bioregenerative is, yeah.
Why is that?
I'm not an engineer, so I can't really give you a good answer to that.
Because people have on their desk, they have, you know, these spheres with three types, you know, fish and an algae and something else in there, and supposedly you give it light and it maintains itself, at least for a while. So I guess my question is, why would it be more difficult?
Yeah, honestly, that's probably beyond me. But in terms of extended duration life support systems, then the background that we have in that is mainly submarines. And
right.
Basically, the engineering background we have, if you think about it, a submarine, they go on a six-month deployment. And that's what we have in terms of learning about the integrity of some of these systems. So basically looking at your question was about bioregenerative. So we're looking at things like biomass, looking at something that produces, stores, and provides agricultural products for food subsystem while regenerating air and water. And so to do that, you need a lot of life support interfaces. You need air interface, a food interface, a thermal control interface. You need a waste interface, a water interface, integrated control interface, the power interface. It's a very, very complex system. And so when you start trying to integrate all these interfaces, because of the complexity of the system, there's more to go wrong, and that's why we haven't actually solved the problem of a bioregenerative life support system, because it's a very, very complex system.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I feel as though it's something we have to do, though. I mean, we can't you know, keep shipping life support inputs to space. I mean, it's got to really provide it all locally.
Hey, Doug, have you gone back in the archives and listened to programs from Constance Adams?
No, I've been overdosing on some other people.
All right, so do some searches. Constance has not been on for a while, but she is one of the closed-loop life support architects that, when funding was there, was doing this for NASA at JSC in Houston, and is probably one of the leading researchers on how to do closed loop. Now, this is for space. It's not for the oceans. But do a search on guest search for Constance Adams and start with her most recent show. It's probably about a year and a half old or something like that. And I should probably see if she would come back on, but I think they've been gutted by funding problems like so many others. So I don't know to the degree to this work going on, but she does address some of the questions from a technical perspective of what you're asking today.
Okay, I'll do that for sure.
Yeah, you'll find her to be a real interesting guest, and maybe I'll see if she wants to come back on and give us some updates. Anything else?
Nope, that's all. Thanks much.
Thank you. Eric, you want to have any closing comments, pearls of wisdom for us? How do you want to leave us today?
Well, I just hope I've provided people who've been listening into an insight into the challenges of going into the ocean, and maybe have them understand some of the analogies between ocean exploration and space exploration. And any environment in which air is absent, whether it's the ocean or space, then we're going to face challenges and risks. But just with any enterprise with great risk is great reward. And that's pretty much the gist of this book. and a lot of my books.
Absolutely. So this book, listeners, and again, it'll be in the archive write-ups with the Amazon URL, Ocean Outpost, The Future of Humans Living Underwater. Now, this is from 2011, correct?
2010, I think.
Okay, I thought I saw the date of 2011 on it.
Oh, 2011, yeah, that's right. 2011.
See, you write so many books, you don't know now when you write them. You know, you're suffering from old age already.
I'm on number 10 now, David.
So you're so prolific. terrific, and I look forward to talking to you in 3 weeks on Astronauts for Hire and returning to the space environment. And, you know, I guess we have a lot of work to do. I wish somehow we had the priorities and the funding, not just the United States, but other countries as well, to really spur advanced research much more than what we do into these environments and into these adventures. I think people all over Earth would be a whole lot better off if we were spending our resources, you know, really learning on how to do more and more in these unique environments. But,
yeah, I absolutely agree.
But I'm not a policymaker, so I guess it doesn't count for much. But I sure think we need different priorities. Always good talking to you, Eric, and I look forward to doing so again in 3 weeks. Thank you for being a guest on the show today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, David. Look forward to it.
Okay, a couple of points, listeners. Don't hang up yet. Rand Simberg is on tomorrow, and he's talking about his Kickstarter project in his book and focus on the fact that we're too risk-averse. John Powell comes back on Tuesday night for updates with JP Aerospace. I have a really interesting show coming up on Tuesday. I don't know when it is. It's a week from Tuesday. But many of you self-invite yourself onto the show, and then you get a letter from me, an email from me telling you why I do not accept self-invited guests. And I'm very polite about it, but I give you the procedures about how to be on the show if you think you're great enough to be on the show, for example. So none of you ever do that. Most of you are PO'd, and I never hear back from you because how dare I zip your entitlement out from underneath you. But that Tuesday night, a week from Tuesday, I'm doing self-invited guest showtime. And if you think that you really should be on the show with whatever your project is or your interest is, you got 10 or 12 minutes to call in, and the show might be a total bust and we cancel it. But I hope some of you who keep saying you want to be on the show and you invite yourself on will call in and let us hear what you have to say and why you would make a good space show guest. So this show on that Tuesday night, and I don't have the date in front of me, but it's a week from this Tuesday. I think it's a week from this Tuesday, or it's the Tuesday. I don't know, like the 16th. It's on the website newsletter, everybody, so I should have had the date in front of me. Check it out on the website newsletter. Go down to future events and you'll see it. And I hope you'll call in. And I'm going to promote the program, and I invite you, whatever it is and whyever you think you need to be a guest on the space show, this is your opportunity to give it your best shot. And we look forward to your participating and seeing what happens. And Eric, again, many thanks for being on the show, and we talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, look forward to it, David.
Okay, that's it, listeners. Goodbye from Dr. Eric Seathouse and the Space Show.